TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. That's a new book by the former Belgian central banker, fund manager, and university professor Bernard Liotard, and the journalist Jackie Dunn, published in 2013. The book is the most up-to-date international overview over complementary currencies and alternative systems of credit. The diversity of these systems is quite staggering. Examples come from Poland, Brazil, Japan, the US, and even the center of all banking, as some see it, Switzerland. But what they all have in common is their response to and critique of the current system of banking and money management. Edgar Kahn, the creator of one such complementary system, time banking, legal scholar and speechwriter to Robert F. Kennedy, summed up the purpose of the book on Rethinking Money. Kahn writes, "Liotard and Dunn explain how and why our monetary system fails to put supply and demand together, subsidizes and promotes intolerable and unnecessary disparities of well-being, entrenches unearned privilege, undermines democracy, creates boom and bust cycles, and rewards unsustainable destructive growth." Liotard and Dunn provide a guided tour to an array of actual alternatives, like time banking, and complementary currencies to create a sustainable, more equitable monetary ecosystem. Those words from Edgar Kahn, founder of Time Banks USA. John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, took an interesting approach in his foreword to the book. He wrote, "Rethinking Money exposes the fallacy of privatization, austerity, tax reform, banking legislation, stimulus packages, and so many other fancy-sounding strategies. The authors explore the monopoly of our centuries-old monetary system." That's what John Perkins had to say. I traveled south to Petaluma, California in March 2013 to record Bernard Liotard and Jackie Dunn at the book release party, only to discover that there was a flaw in the public address system that ruined the recording. So I will play only part of what I recorded so you can get a sense of their personalities, and will paraphrase the rest and quote from their book, Rethinking Money. It is important to me to insert Liotard and Dunn's work into the collection of TUC Radio recordings on banking and money, because their description of complementary systems illuminates the flaws of the global banking monopoly and shows the growing movement to create locally based currency and credit systems. Here's Jackie Dunn, followed by Bernard Liotard.
Well, we want to ask the question, what is money? And if you open up any economics textbook, they will tell you what it does, but not what it is. They'll tell you it's a unit of account, it's a medium of exchange, it's a store of value, but not exactly what it is. And we say that money is an agreement. It is an agreement to use something as a medium of exchange. So all through history, all types of things have been used as a medium of exchange. Shells, axes. In prisons, they use cigarettes. In the Second World War, they use women's nylons as a medium of exchange. So money is not a thing. I'm sure when you went to your mom or your dad when you were kids and asked for something, and you were told that money does not grow on trees, she was right. It is not a thing of nature. It is a mental construct.
Well, I'm using a metaphor to describe different kinds of money. Is this better? It sounds very terrible. Imagine the normal economy as the ocean. And there are lots of fish in there, of all kinds, and all kinds of animals and plants, and there's a whole universe there. Still working? No. All right. Well, now, but there's still, when you look at what the economy does, there is still a whole bunch of things that are sticking out. Unused resources on the one side and unmet needs on the other. Things that the normal economy neglects, either because people don't have the money, that's one possibility, or that resources, well, imagine empty chairs in a restaurant before hours, spaces in offices after or before hours, lots of idle people, unemployed people, there's an enormous amount of skills and resources there that are actually not tapped by the economy. Now, what is a complementary currency? It's something that links these two things. How many of you have already used complementary currency? Wow, this is an enlightened community. Are there people who have been using frequent flyer miles without that didn't lift their hands? Okay, so you are among those that have been using complementary currencies without knowing it. So by the time that you count all the people who have done it and all the people who are not aware that have done it, that makes a hell of a lot of people. In fact, we're not describing of something in the future. It's something that already has happened. And by the way, the miles is just one model. Today, there are literally hundreds of thousands of loyalty systems of that nature around. What do they have in common? Well, from the airline's viewpoint, the unmet need was customer loyalty. And the unused resource is an empty seat. And they're setting up a little bridge between the two called frequent flyer miles that actually get you to link that what you want with what they want. And the empty seat is ensured to be kept empty because they have a whole series of rules and principles called blackout periods around Christmas and Thanksgiving and all that stuff to make sure that the seat you're sitting in is an empty one. The marginal cost of them to zero is zero. So this is actually a technique to use unused spare capacity. Now, besides for the airline's viewpoint itself, it really doesn't serve much of social purposes or societal purposes, right? It's relevant for airlines, but not for anybody else. What we're talking about tonight is basically use this technology, which is now well established. This is 40 years we've been doing this, for things that are mattering, for things that are useful. Things like elderly care, things like mentoring kids, things like environmental issues, things like employment, jobs. All these things can be addressed with one of those bridges. So when I came here to look at this stuff, there were a couple of hundred in the world. There were the first prototypes. Actually, in 1984, there were only two. By now, I stopped counting in 2006, 2007, because there's been an explosion. With the crisis, this has been going on in high speed. And there are literally, well, I don't want to put numbers on it, because, for example, just in one type of currency, time banking in America, there are two systems per week coming up in the United States alone. But don't mistake this to mean that this is coming from the crisis. This is all before the crisis, right? So this is a process. This is the first time in history, actually, that we have this development occurring before there was a crisis. It has occurred in the 30s. It has occurred in 1890. It has occurred in previous crises. But this was different because it started before. And I think it is also going to last beyond this crisis because it is basically part of the information age. The idea of a monopoly of a single currency is an industrial age construct. And it is going to die with the industrial age. We're not getting rid of the old system. Let's be careful. We're not naive. All we're saying is they will lose the monopoly of it. It's already done. It has already happened. And we're now finding out which are the better models for what purpose.
That was Bernard Liotard, co-author with Jackie Dunn of Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. My apologies for the flaws in the sound that came from the local PA system. Before describing in detail many complementary systems of currency and credit from all across the world, Dunn and Liotard point out the deep flaws in the global money system. They write, "At present, our unexamined money system perpetuates scarcity and breeds competition. Are you aware that money is created out of nothing, as bank debt, and how that particular process of creation breeds systematic competition among its users? Did you know that the prevailing money system generates several other harmful consequences, including short-termism, compulsory growth pressure, cyclical recessions, unrelenting concentration of wealth, and erosion of social and physical or natural capital? All these factors together create a wholly unsustainable financial structure that is, indeed, disintegrating now. So how did we get here? Modern money, the type we use today, was invented in a very different time, with a different worldview and another set of priorities and challenges than we have today. Money was fashioned back in the 1700s in Europe, and then evolved, first in England, to become the engine for the Industrial Revolution. Up until that point, the vast majority of people eked out meager existences, while real wealth was obtained mainly through the spoils of war or colonization, marriage or inheritance. Through the emergence of modern central banking and its conventions during this time, it was possible to make money out of money. This gave birth to the new merchant and middle classes. Soon, money became the tool empires used in a global dash for assets in a world that didn't seem to lack for earth, water, air, and natural resources. A contrivance of competition, it pitted one against the other in a fabricated Darwinian contest of survival. This is the underpinning of the great American dream, which has been triumphantly exported to the rest of the world after the fall of the Berlin Wall and rise of the Iron Curtain. Today, for instance, China, India, Brazil, and Poland, with their meteoric growth and the rise of their own meritocracies, are prime examples. That dream, however, has turned into a nightmare. We now have scientific proof that the monoculture of a single type of currency is a root cause of the repeated monetary and financial instabilities that have manifested throughout modern history. According to the International Monetary Fund, in the 4 decades between 1970 and 2010, there were no fewer than 145 banking crises, 208 monetary crashes, and 72 sovereign debt crises. This adds up to an astounding total of 425 systemic crises, an average of more than 10 countries in crises each and every year. As we begin to lift the shroud in this book, we will see that it's not the structure of the economy or the hue of the political solution per se that are the real problems. The real problems are money and the monetary system itself, and not in the way one might first suspect. We will see that since money is a human invention, it can be changed. We'll see that there's not only another way, but a multiplicity of ways to rethink money. And we'll learn that already a quiet evolution is underway, in which people and their communities are helping themselves through a new understanding of money. Regular people have discovered not only that it is possible to create money in sufficiency for their needs, but also that it is simultaneously possible to build their societies with greater cooperation, care, and collaboration. In other words, they are proving not only that it is possible to redesign money, but also that doing so fosters very different and highly desirable outcomes. In fact, the past 30 years has seen a tremendous growth of cooperative currencies around the world, from fewer than a handful in 1980 to more than 4,000 today. These cooperative currencies are often called complementary currencies. Examples include community or local currencies, such as time dollars in the United States, long-established business-to-business systems, like the Vier in Switzerland, and newer currencies, like the Regio and the Terra. There are reports of communities going from high unemployment, despair, and high crime rates to self-sufficiency, mutual support, and sustainable abundance. You are listening to a reading from Rethinking Money, a two-part program based on the book by the former central banker Bernard Liotard from Belgium and the American journalist Jackie Dunn. They state in their opening chapter that this book, Rethinking Money, is not about how to invest, save, spend, hide, keep, or give away money. Rather, the aim is to unmask the true nature of money and the monetary system that we have inherited. By understanding how money really works, we might then create a different system that supports the kind of society we desire for ourselves and for future generations. The first step is to take stock of where we are. Currently, as infrastructure crumbles in the United States and in many other nations, and the availability of high-quality education and healthcare plummets, with massively underfunded liabilities, the stark statistics still don't tell the full story. The situation is particularly dire in Europe. Greece, Spain, Ireland, and the United Kingdom are in a credit crunch not seen in generations. Even in the countries that were up until recently considered booming, nations like the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, development was highly uneven, with entire regions experiencing scarcity and need. Now it would appear that their economic bloom is wilting. Practically everywhere, one finds many tales of how the highly competitive nature of the conventional money system influences our lives. This is a reading from the book Rethinking Money. Now, the next chapter is entitled The Dash for Cash, and it is very interesting because it explains a movement of privatization and so-called private-public partnerships that we have come to associate with third world countries, or the fire sale of so many people's assets after the fall of the Soviet Union. This movement has already come to Greece, Spain, Italy, etc., and it has well established itself in the USA. And it is the very dangerous consequence to the more and more frequent bankruptcies of cities, states, and whole countries. Liotard and Dunn write, "Beyond the daily monetary melee that is playing out on the personal level, some 44 states in the Union are considering bankruptcy, and dozens of cities across the nation are faced with inevitable budget shortfalls. The Riverport City of Stockton, California, is the largest U.S. city to lately declare bankruptcy." And I'll insert here, this was written before the city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy in July 2013. Detroit is now the largest municipal bankruptcy filing by debt, estimated at $18 to $20 billion. Liotard and Dunn continue. In the meantime, at various levels of officialdom globally, it is believed that the only way out of the current credit crunch is the forfeiture of assets in the blaze of fire sales. Some 28 states have passed private-public partnerships, so-called PPPs, and the enabling statutes. Despite the benign-sounding label, these statutes mean that governments at whatever level are selling off existing infrastructure that has already been built and paid for with taxpayers' money. And they do it to reduce existing debt if they are unable to meet current governmental expenses. Once something is privatized, the new owner will certainly charge fees for the use of any once free public utility, or will increase existing tolls. Consequently, taxpayers will end up paying twice for the same infrastructure, and the second time could be more expensive than the first, given that many infrastructure assets are monopolies. The total value of U.S. government fixed assets at federal, state, and local levels combined was an estimated $9.3 trillion in 2008. Of this, $1.9 trillion is owned by the federal government and $7.4 trillion is held at state and local levels. The value of all the highways and roads owned by states and municipalities is $2.4 trillion. Their sewerage assets worth $550 billion at state and local levels, along with a further $400 billion of water assets. And in the real estate sector, the federal, state, and local governments own assets worth $1.09 trillion. The evidence reveals that PPPs, rather than being entrepreneurial ventures to create work and unleash massive opportunities for the general population, actually favor buying up existing assets instead of building new ones, because the time required and risks involved are much higher with new projects. The competition to acquire real assets, whether through PPP programs or the wealthy simply buying up whatever they can before currency gets devalued, leads to an even greater concentration of wealth as the deepening of privatization plays out. Ordinary people are less and less able to afford access to local library, for instance, since what was once a public service now requires a subscription, like a membership fee to a private club. With this new concentration of monetary and financial power, François Morin, a financial advisor to the highest ranks of European government and the European Central Bank, asks, is this new global financial paradigm not having a dissolving effect on our democratic societies? These were quotes from the 2013 book Rethinking Money by Bernard Liotard and Jackie Dunn. Liotard is a university professor, currently a fellow at the Center for Sustainable Resources at the University of California, Berkeley, and former central banker and fund manager. He studies monetary systems and promotes the idea that communities can benefit from creating their own local complementary currencies. Jackie Dunn is an award-winning journalist and CEO of a U.S.-based enterprise that assists entrepreneurs in the development of technologies that restore the Earth's equilibrium. I'm ending with a little fable Liotard and Dunn tell in Rethinking Money as invitation to you to come back when TUC Radio returns for a world tour of grassroots currencies and credit systems, and as another inspiration to consider how strange our current money system really is. A tourist arrives in a small town, stops at the hotel, and lays a $100 bill on the desk, saying he wants to inspect the rooms upstairs to pick one for the night. As soon as he walks upstairs, the hotel owner grabs the bill and runs next door to pay his debt to the butcher. The butcher takes the $100 and runs down the street to retire his debt to the pig farmer. The pig farmer takes the $100 and heads off to pay his bill to his supplier, the co-op. The guy at the co-op takes the $100 and runs to pay his debt to the local prostitute, who has also been facing hard times and has had to offer her services on credit. The hooker rushes to the hotel and pays off her room bill with the hotel owner. The hotel owner places the $100 back on the counter so the traveler will not suspect anything. At that moment, the traveler comes down the stairs, states that the rooms are not satisfactory, picks up the $100 bill, and leaves. That was the last excerpt from Rethinking Money by Bernard Liotard and Jackie Dunn. Come back when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD at cost of the one-hour program on Rethinking Money by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. You can also place an order on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org or 707-463-2654 for more information. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.